for joining me for this week's Yes to Life show. My name's Robin Daly, and I'm the founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. Each week, I'm speaking to people in the field of cancer care, cancer research, as well as those diagnosed themselves, to find out what's new, what's working, and why. This week, I'm speaking to one of the UK's most prolific and popular authors on nutrition and health, Patrick Holford. Patrick's first book on cancer came out in 1999, since which time he's spoken publicly on the topic regularly. I was delighted to be able to visit him at his home in Southwest London to hear his current thinking on cancer. Okay, morning Patrick, thanks a lot for coming on the Yes to Life show.
A pleasure, thanks for having me.
Great. So most oncologists in the UK seem to be still telling their patients that it just doesn't matter what they eat. A good balanced diet is all they need, unless that is they have cachexia or wasting, in which case a specialist dietitian will recommend high carb foods to put the weight back on. How does this advice sit with you?
Well, it means that they never bothered to read the amazing and significant document generated by the World Cancer Research Fund. Many years ago, the work of Dr. Jeffrey Cannon, he helped to get a lot of experts together to really look at the connection between diet and cancer, which is very, very strong indeed. So I think the real problem, not just with cancer, but many diseases, is that the sort of mentality is you've got a disease which now needs to be destroyed, the cancer cells need to be killed, the tumour needs to be removed, and the fundamental question is what is the cause is not being asked. And very often the issue here is that medicine likes a single cause, and there isn't a single cause for cancer. We are really looking at a situation where the body and the cells, which communicate very well together, have now decided not to cooperate, and some cells have gone rogue. So it's crazy to remove a tumour, keep eating and living in the way that you have been, and expect that it won't come back. So it's just prehistoric.
Right, so you depart substantially on that advice. And how about the advice for cachexia?
Well, I mean, you obviously do need to, build up the body, but you want to do this with really good nutrients. And the thing is, it's quite complicated. I mean, for example, we know for a fact that if you consume dairy products, you are going to raise the level in the body of insulin-like growth factor, or IGF-1. Some people think that this is within milk, and yes, there is some in milk or in dairy products, but actually milk's function is to tell the body to make hormones that stimulate growth of cells. And if you happen to have cancer cells, they will grow. So if you want to fill someone up with calories from dairy products, you're actually sending a hormonal message to cancer cells to grow. The same is also true with sugar. We know that sugar encourages cancer cell growth. So food is not inert. There's quite a lot of very interesting evidence, particularly in relation to brain tumours, of having a diet that is completely, carbohydrate free. So a much higher protein fat diet, no carbs. But even so, there are some cancers, particularly, colorectal cancer, for example, where we know that the cells that line the gut actually feed off glutamine. Glutamine is an amino acid. So you've got to be a little bit careful too, because if you put in a lot of animal products with lots of glutamine, that could have detrimental effects. So the point is that food is very powerful, and the nutrients in food are very powerful. And if a person is sick with cancer or any disease, it's absolutely vital to make sure that the calories that you are giving are of the highest possible quality, with a lot of different nutrients. And we're talking not just about antioxidant nutrients, but things like vitamin D, which are higher in fish. Obviously avoiding foods that contain known carcinogens. So how you cook a food can introduce carcinogens. So, as a whole topic, I mean, when I wrote the book Say No to Cancer with Liz Effiong, we went through all the research that was there. It starts to define the kind of eating that is consistent with both preventing and reversing cancer.
That's a big deal. So here in the UK, we're seeing an astronomical rise in chronic conditions, including cancer. And that's despite all the good news that we hear about, you know, progress with cancer, you know. It's just going up and up. So is there any one thing that you put your finger on as being the main driver of all this ill health?
Well, I do think, I mean, we've moved. I remember when I first came into nutrition, the lifetime risk of cancer was about 1 in 10. It's now crossed the 1 in 3 mark, and it's moving up to 1 in 2. And the 5-year survival rate has improved a little. And of course, this depends on which figures you look at. But something like, you know, maybe it used to be 45% surviving, and now it's sort of 55%. It depends how you look at it. And this is what heralded a recent announcement, which said more people are surviving cancer than dying from cancer. Now, this is true, but it's not really showing any great results.
I mean, terribly good news.
No, I mean, in broad figures in America, you know, we're talking about, you know, 1 million people a year being diagnosed with cancer and 500,000 dying. And whether it turns out to be 480,000, you know, versus 520,000, it really means we are absolutely not winning the cancer war. And I think the reason we aren't is because we're still not really truly addressing the causes. And certainly what's happened when we see this explosion in obesity and diabetes, I do think that that's one of the biggest stresses that the modern diet has put onto our biology. It's too many carbs, losing blood sugar control. As a consequence, you get more insulin. Our diets are fairly skewed towards dairy. And the reason why I mentioned the dairy factor is that the three cancers that are really causing the biggest problems is breast cancer, prostate cancer, and colorectal cancer. You know, lung cancer, to a certain extent, we can say is very much on the decrease, and smoking, you know, as smoking is on the decrease. But it's those three cancers that are not. Colorectal cancer is, you know, fairly close to becoming the number one killer of people under the age of 40. So that's, you know, that's very much a growing instance among young people. And breast and prostate cancer are the two that are most strongly linked with too much insulin and insulin-like growth factor. And that's why I would say that it is the overconsumption of sugar and also the overconsumption of dairy products that I think is, you know, is a large part of why we are not seeing great changes.
Okay, so to summarise that, you're saying that diet then mm-hmm. is number one cause of...
Fundamental, yeah, yes.
Right, of what's going on. How much effect do you think that we can personally have on our likelihood of getting cancer?
Well, I really think a tremendous amount. I do not think that cancer is... I think it's a preventable disease in the same way that diabetes, heart disease is preventable. A lot of my work recently has been in Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And we know that only 1% of Alzheimer's is caused by genes. We know that at least half of the causes are things that we can change. And I'm sure the same is true with cancer. Now, the truth is that, you know, there isn't just one cancer. There are many, many different kinds. So it's a little bit hard to have a broad sweeping statement. Because if you take, I mean, number one, we have a lot of carcinogens. These are substances that can trigger a cell to misbehave. And you know, they vary for the cancers. I mean, for example, the fact that brain cancers are becoming, you know, very prevalent has to make you question other new, you know, behaviours. And I always thought that it would be relatively easy to find out if mobile phone use was associated simply by looking at the location of the tumour, i.e. on the left or right side of the brain, whether the person was left or right-handed. And that survey was done quite a few years ago, and sure enough, what they found was that left-eared mobile phone users were much more likely to have left-sided tumours, and so, you know, and the same on the other side. So we've got carcinogens, but the point is that I used to tell a story, which I think is the conventional story, and that is that DNA gets damaged by carcinogens. We are always getting DNA damage, which can be repaired. So, for example, one of the fundamental repair mechanisms is called methylation. It depends on B vitamins. It depends on zinc. The story is, if you don't repair your DNA damage, a cell can misbehave and become a cancer cell. We then have genes that promote its growth or suppress its growth. And substances, for example, like, you know, insulin-like growth factor, which can make the cancer cell grow. So there's a way you can influence the growth of a pre-existing cancer cell. And then, of course, you have the immune system, whose job is to spot cells that are not behaving and take it out. So there are at least four places, that is, limiting carcinogens, improving DNA repair, reducing growth factor stimulation, and improving the immune system. There are four places in which nutrition can make a difference. But I'm not sure that story is correct anymore. I was very impressed by a couple of pieces of research which really tell a story. And I'm sort of paraphrasing here. The idea, the big idea, is that, you know, that something wrong with your genes that makes the cancer happen. And, you know, the idea is that we find what's the gene mutation that causes a particular cancer. Now, in the old days, it was very hard and expensive to sequence a person's genes. Now it's quite easy. And if you take 100 women with breast cancer and you sequence their genes, looking for the genetic mutation that would explain breast cancer, you actually don't find one. What you find is that everyone's different. So that's kind of a big blow for the gene concept.
It is.
It really is. But then the other series of studies, which went something like this, was taking a cancer cell's nucleus. That's where the DNA is. So if the cancer is in the DNA, they took the cancer cell's nucleus, they put it into a healthy cell. Think of it like the nucleus is like the yolk and the rest of the cell, the white is called the cytoplasm. So they put a cancer cell's nucleus in a healthy cell's cytoplasm and put that into 100 mice, expecting that they would develop cancer. And only one out of 100 did. And then the reverse study was done, where they took a cancer cell's white or cytoplasm and put in a healthy cell's nucleus. And I believe 98 out of 100 animals developed cancer. So there's a return to what was originally proposed by a man called Otto Warburg back in the 1930s. And that is that what happens is a normal cell only becomes a cancer cell if it's given a very tough environment in which to survive. It actually switches, said Otto Warburg, to what we call anaerobic metabolism. So its sugar fuel supply is messed up, and it finds another way of surviving. And in the process of doing this, it appears that what might happen is that the cell, which is now desperate to survive, sends a message to the nucleus, to the DNA, to the sort of central control, saying, help, you know, it's an emergency situation, you know, give me some new tricks. And DNA starts to change. So yes, we see strange DNA in cancer cells, but it's looking like this might not be the cause of the cancer, but the consequence of the cancer cell now, you know, scrambling DNA and changing messages. So there's been this total focus that it all comes from the DNA, and actually it may come from the environment of the cell. And that starts to put nutrition into a totally different situation. So part of my kind of natural chemotherapy is to create a sort of biochemical soup in your body to take in all the appropriate nutrients, herbs, and so on, to create an environment that is almost impossible for a cancer cell to thrive in. And that is a new way of looking. And to give you an example, I've been interviewing various sort of integrative oncologists and cancer experts who are using different nutritional strategies. And although they often, you know, will come up with similar recommendations, what's very clear is that some have hardwired in the way that they are approaching cancer this new approach about creating the optimal environment where it's incredibly tough for a cancer cell to survive. Others really are still in the thinking that you've got to kill the cancer. And they just happen to have seen some fairly convincing evidence, perhaps on turmeric or on vitamin C or whatever it happens to be. So they've seen a study which shows that these things do seem to work. So they've added them into the mix, but they're still thinking, you know, in the old way, which is, you know, we've just got to kill the cancer cell. They're not thinking in a truly integral way, realizing that it's the environment of cells that allows them to start to misbehave and disrespect their neighbors.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. This is a sort of recurrent theme in my programs, so this kind of chicken and egg with the genes, or is it the metabolism gone wrong that's actually the problem? The great news about the metabolic theory, if it happens to be right, is that, of course, you don't have everybody with a different gene pattern that needs to be treated differently. You actually have one common problem in cancer, which can be addressed. And so you can look to solutions which would be helpful to anyone with cancer.
Well, yes, I mean, that's also something I sort of intuitively like as well, not as a rule, but as a sort of general principle. And that is that if what helps you to cure a disease happens to be good for you anyway,
right,
then it sort of makes sense that your curative program actually becomes a restorative program and then becomes a way of life. However, I do think that there are some situations where this doesn't apply, and it's like, I mean, I've fought in my sort of scientific life in nutrition this idea that, you know, you can get all the nutrients you need from a well-balanced diet, you know, as simple as that. And one of my first teachers, Dr. Linus Pauling, who had 48 PhDs and 2 Nobel Prizes, he did this extraordinary study with an oncologist back in the, I think it was the 60s, early 70s, Ewan Cameron from Scotland, where they took a group of terminal cancer patients and gave them many grams of vitamin C, both orally and injected. And by the way, a gram of vitamin C is 20 oranges. So we are talking way beyond what you could eat. Mm-hmm. And they found a tremendous result in these terminal cancer patients. I mean, in real terms, 22% of the terminal cancer patients didn't die. So the point I'm making here is that when a system is out of balance, what you need to bring it back into balance is far more than what you need to maintain it. It's a little bit like, you know, if you put your back out, somebody may say, well, actually, you slouch, you know, you don't sit properly and you need to do exercise and have some stronger muscles. But now you've put your back out, will sitting upright in a chair put your spine back into alignment? The answer is no. You need to see an osteopath or a chiropractor, get adjusted, and then start to do the right prevention steps. Right. So very often in a disease state, as well as having the background of, you know, really good nutrition and a good lifestyle, and also, you know, there are emotional factors here for sure in relation to cancer. There are some nutrients that need to be consumed, and some herbs as well, at a level that you would not consume, you know, in a natural wild diet to restore health. That's my belief.
Okay, well, look, developing that a bit further, given that the current technologies that we've got, right, our understanding is growing all the time, but we're also aware of the fact of how little we know with cancer. Given that the technologies we got, and given people's urgent need to do something about their situation currently, it seems to me that there is a place where you talked about these two models of killing cancer and actually restoring the body, and the cancer itself can be a threat under some circumstances, physically, quite apart from the process that's going on in the body. It can be impinging on an organ or whatever it is. And so it seems that sometimes the orthodox model, which is of killing cancer cells, is something you kind of need to do to get an upper hand so that you can then do some of the other work. So, what do you think about
that? Well, yes. I mean, sometimes, you know, we generally talk about cancer treatment being, you know, chopping it out, you know, drugging it out or sort of burning it out with radiation. And I do believe, I mean, if someone's got a tumour mass, the idea, and let's assume their immune system is suppressed, depressed, under-functioning. And if you just went down a natural route, then what you're asking the body's immune system to do is to go from very poor function to super amazing function to actually consume, you know, a cancer mass. Now, I think that's a very, very, very big ask.
Yeah.
So logically, it makes sense to me that if you do have a tumor mass and it's removable, you remove it, you know, as much as possible. And I do think that the small successes that have happened in cancer treatment have largely been to do with better and more refined surgery. I mean, we've learned, for example, that the, you know, the total mastectomy is often really not necessary, mm-hmm. and lumpectomies work better. So yes, I'm kind of pro surgery.
Okay.
Where it gets a little tricky is in extended chemotherapy, because again you have a situation here where a lot of the chemotherapeutic drugs, although they may actually be somewhat effective against a particular, you know, cancer cell type, they are themselves again weakening the immune system. Mm. So it's sort of two steps forward, one step back. And of course, the longer you play this game, the weaker and weaker a person is likely to become. And that's the real danger. So I think, and also one of the sort of misunderstandings here is that chemotherapy, which is it's kind of an interesting word, and we're just talking about a chemical substance that happens to inhibit cancer cell growth or kill cancer cells. Now, there are many natural compounds which also are chemotherapy. You know, they do that. They kill cancer cells or reduce its growth. And some of them have no downsides. Mm. So the point is, in looking at you know, the substances that one would use for a chemical approach to cancer, you not only have to look at how effective is this substance on this particular kind of cancer, but also how great are the downsides.
Right.
It's absolutely vital. And also, because there are many different mechanisms to reduce cancer cell growth and kill off cancer cells, for example, you can cut off its blood supply, anti-angiogenesis, you know, that's one mechanism. The other fascinating mechanism, which is still sort of hovering in the wings, was the discovery of an enzyme which is only present in cancer cells called CYP1B1. And it turns out that a lot of plants contain compounds called salvestrols, resveratrol, that's the stuff in the skin of red grapes and red peanuts is a salvestrol. And these compounds actually are converted by an enzyme, CYP1B1, which is only in cancer cells, not in healthy cells, into something that kills the cancer cell. So here you've got here you're starting to get towards the holy grail of chemotherapy, which is an agent that only targets the cancer cell, not the healthy cell, and has minimum downsides. And I know you've, in fact, you told me originally about photodynamic therapy, you know, PDT.
Yeah.
And this, again, if somebody has a tumor which is accessible, photodynamic therapy provides a chemotherapy agent which is only activated by light. And in this particular approach, PDT, a sort of fiber optic cable is put into the tumor mass. And when the light is turned on, the drug becomes active, but only in that area. So again, there's minimum downsides. So I think the same thing exists in medicine. We look at the technical term was the numbers needed to treat for a benefit.
Hmm.
So we know for statins, for people who haven't had a heart attack, it's 100. In other words, 100 men have to take a statin for there to be one less non-fatal heart attack.
Right.
So we call that a number needed to treat for benefit of 100. But also there's the other side, which is the numbers needed to treat for harm.
Hmm.
So there's a debate using the statin analogy as to whether it's 10 or 20% of people who get side effects. So if it were 10 in 100, that would be an NNT of harm of 10. So in a sense, we need to look at these chemotherapy agents and say, you know, a concentrate of turmeric has this effect, of vitamin C has this effect, of mistletoe has this effect, and, you know, look at the drugs, but also look at the downsides. And I think if we really looked at both the upside and the downside, we'd start to find that a lot of these natural agents are competing exceedingly well with the more toxic drug compounds.
Mm. Well, yes, and that's great to hear. And so, it behoves everybody who's got cancer to kind of do their homework and find out what's out there. Because as you say, there's no downside to these that we know of particularly, is there at all?
I think one of the hard things and one of the great things about your charity, Yes to Life, is that when a person is diagnosed with cancer, obviously it's a emotional whirlwind.
Absolutely.
And they probably, in most cases, wouldn't have got there if they were totally, genned up and switched on to nutrition. So people are usually going from sort of ground zero to suddenly having to become an expert, in nutrition and herbal medicine. So, there's book after book after book and information on the website and so on. And I mean, I'm doing a seminar in a couple of weeks. And one of the reasons for doing it is that I literally do not have a week pass now where there isn't someone I know or relative of someone I know or one of the members of my club who's saying, my relative has been diagnosed with cancer. What do I do? And apart from having good integrative oncologists and great books out there and websites and all the rest of it, I think there's this need for somebody to hold your hand, look at the situation that you're facing and kind of make a short list, help you through that maze.
You need to feed the information at the rate the person can take it. And the most important things first.
Yes, and I think that's, so we're not talking about, the doctor that you line up with or even the nutritionist. We're talking about somebody who can, get you going in the right directions and, reading the right material.
It's important, as you say, for some people, this is maybe their first step outside of the box of thinking about their own relationship to their own health ever.
Yes.
So it's very important. Yeah. Back earlier on, you mentioned about dietary approaches being used. One of the things that's been talked about a lot is ketogenic diet, which is kind of what you're referring to with brain cancers. Do you want to say a bit more about what you think about the ketogenic diet, how useful you think it is in cancer?
Well, this is one of the interesting areas. While I said, my sort of general, not rule, but principle, is that if you're doing something, to treat a disease that is generally good for you anyway, then, why not? A pure ketogenic diet, which means basically the cells run on sugar, glucose, or ketones. And ketones is really the backup mechanism for generating energy. Ketones are most easy. I mean, if you starve yourself of sugar, your body will generate ketones by breaking down your body fat. So an Atkins diet is aiming to be a ketogenic diet. So you burn fat. And one of the fastest ways to generate ketones is to actually consume certain kinds of fats, which are called MCTs. Coconut oil, for example, helps to generate ketones. And there, some researchers are now generating synthetic ketones. So there is a future not far away where you can actually consume ketones in the way that you would consume glucose.
Wow. So
that's kind of interesting. And I think the idea here, and it comes back to the idea that one of the reasons we've got this increase in cancer is because we're consuming too much sugar and carbs, is that a cell, a cancer cell, cannot function very well on a ketogenic diet, on ketones, while a healthy cell can. So you're trying to make a situation where, again, it's hard for a cancer cell to survive. Now, I'm just a little wary in this area. I mean, at the moment, and this is the fourth time in my career since the 80s, there's a big push on, low-carb diets, whether it's Atkins or Banting or, even paleo is kind of in that territory. And the strict ketogenic diet, or Banting diet, actually encourages eating very fatty foods, which basically means meat and dairy products. And people are encouraged, this is more in the sort of weight loss area than the cancer area, to eat animals that have at least 30% of their body weight as fat. And even boil off the lard and keep it, and consume it. Now, I got a little problem with this. I mean, number one, in the wild, animals are fit and they have very little fat. About a wild animal on average has about 5% of its body weight as fat. So if you want to eat really fatty meats How do you make an animal that fat? And the answer is you feed it carbs. You feed it corn. So we feed corn to pigs and cows and chickens and, you know, corn fed and so on. And the reason we do that is because the carbs convert to fat, and then you've got a bigger animal that you can sell for more money. So there's a slight irony there. The other issue is that if you look at colorectal cancer, which is, you know, I would say number three of the most important cancers to deal with. I've been saying this for years. This is really nothing new. I've been saying this since the mid 80s. We know that a lot of red meat, and particularly burnt meat, which generates a carcinogen called a polyaromatic hydrocarbon, or a PAH, and also HCAs, heterocyclic amines. If you cure meat with nitrates, as in bacon, for example, the nitrates can combine with amines in the gut to produce nitrous amines. So now we've got three known carcinogens in the gut. Now, the other issue is that if you eat a ketogenic diet, it's quite hard to get enough fiber, because obviously fiber is coming from things like beans and nuts and seeds and vegetables and oats and, you know, other such foods. So very often people on a sort of Atkins type diet, they become more constipated. And even if they're not constipated, the amount of time it takes for food to leave the body is much longer, which means more time for putrefaction. And if you're doing meat and dairy as your source of ketones, cheese, for example, once again, you're sending in a message for growth. So I am not against ketogenic diets, but I think they are more effective in some cancers than others. I would be very, very wary about using that approach in colorectal cancer. I think the best results have been seen in brain cancers. Mm. And I think that this is not a way to live, but it is perhaps another piece of the armory for a few months of giving cancer cells a very, very hard time. So I'm kind of, that's where I stand on ketogenic diets.
All right. So it's good in some cases. Okay, so that kind of takes me on to a question I pursue quite a lot, which is between, there's the one-size-fits-all dietary advice, where it's a Mediterranean diet, good for everybody. And then there are people who come at it and say, well, no, Mediterranean diet's good for Mediterranean people, and actually something else might be good for people who live elsewhere. Where do you sit with that?
Well, I think there is a general direction of a diet that is probably good for everyone. So this is like saying we are all human beings and there are certain fundamentals that we do need.
Okay.
So, you know, we all need vitamin D, we all need, you know, vitamin C. And I would, you know, go as far as saying that, you know, generally we all function, you know, better on more fish, less meat, lots of vegetables, lots of antioxidants, and so on. So, you know, I think there is not a one-size-fits-all, but there's a one general diet that is generally what human beings function well on. Then you come down to the issue of personalization and what a person specifically needs. And historically, we've had lots of approaches like metabolic typing, which says you are this type or you are that type. One of the sort of popular versions of that was, you know, was the blood type diet, where if you're an A type, you are said to be better suited to a bit less protein, animal protein, you know, more vegetarian based carbs. And if you're an O type, you know, then you might do, you know, better on more protein and so on. So I actually think there is some truth to that, not just blood typing, but that we are, there are different metabolic types. And I think that one thing that hasn't really been fully processed is that the old idea was that our genes take a very, very long time to change. In other words, it's the story, which is incorrect, is that a gene gets damaged, usually by oxidation. And the idea is every now and again, some gene change confers an advantage. And then the family with that gene change then become dominant through a process of natural selection. So that's the story. Mm-hmm. But what we now know is that genes aren't an on-off switch. They can be upregulated, downregulated. They're like a dimmer switch. And this whole new field of epigenetics, that is the effect of the environment on gene expression, that's how it's called, shows us not only that you can change gene signaling immediately, I mean literally, you know, in a minute by you know, changing what you eat, for example, but also you can pass on those gene switches to your offspring. Mm. So in other words, a diabetic mother is not just passing on her genes to a child, but her gene pattern, if you like, her gene switching. So when you realize that we are so much more adaptable than we thought, then it really does make sense that Eskimos' metabolism will have adapted, you know, very, very different to someone living in equatorial regions.
Absolutely.
So I mean, sometimes it's a matter of, you know, suck it and see. You know, you try different approaches and you find what really makes you feel good. I'm encouraged by the fact, specifically in relation to cancer, that we do have organizations such as the Research Genetic Cancer Center in Greece, that's RGCC. And these are one of the labs, but there are now others as well, who can take specific cancer cells and find out what agents work against those specific cancer cells. So in this whole area of personalization, rather than saying, you know, my favorite natural chemotherapy is vitamin C or turmeric or Artemisia or whatever it happens to be, we're now moving into an era. And by the way, the, you know, big pharma are also very much on this case, except their armor is more to do with drugs. But we're moving into an era where you can find out specifically what agents seem to have the biggest effect on a person's specific cancer cells. And that's a good step in the right direction.
Right. Okay. And another question that I always like to ask people who are involved with nutrition at all is about how much of the impact that the general degradation of our public health is to do with the actual food choices that people make, and how much of it is to do with what's been done to the food. So you can have a pint of milk, and you can buy some semi-skimmed stuff in a plastic carton from the supermarket, or you can buy raw milk from the farm. Now, these are quite different things. And so how much of the poor health is to do with the degraded food?
Well, there's another factor that most people don't have much awareness about, and that is that we're eating far less than our ancestors used to eat. Mm. Right? You might think it's the other way around, but it's not. The truth is, if you go back, just as an example, to the early Victorian age diet, you find that because people were burning off a ton more calories just in living, you know, you've got to chop the wood and fetch the water and obviously walk to work, and you know, work is a lot more manual anyway. Mm. As a consequence, we were eating a lot more food. And also, none of the food was refined because we didn't really have the means to do that. We had no fridges. So there's no storage of food. And therefore, you know, 90% of the food that we were eating had to be fresh and whole and organic. And we were eating a lot of it. So one calculation, this was in the Royal Society of Health, in an article in the Royal Society of Health by a man called Dr. Paul Clayton, worked out that in order to achieve the same intake of vitamins and minerals that even a poor, you know, early Victorian worker would have been achieving from their food today, you would need to either supplement nutrients on top of what you are eating, or effectively, you know, run a marathon or half a marathon a day and double your quantity of food. Mm. So in other words, when we talk about eating 5 servings of fruit and veg a day, and actually it probably would be more like 7, You'd need quantity to even get to the right level of nutrients, never mind whether we're talking about organic or non-organic and so on. So I think that's one factor, is that we need to really wait. And when you realize that, you realize that you don't want to waste any of your food calories. In other words, you want almost everything that's going into your mouth to be very nutrient dense. When you eat, you know, the rubbish, you've actually just lost, you know, a quarter of your opportunity.
Yeah.
But then, as you say, then there's the other side of it. You see, I've been a tremendous supporter of organic food. And for the very, very simple reason that if you're going to use compounds that kill pests, pesticides, you know, they're obviously not going to be good for you. And the only difference is the quantity. In other words, are we consuming a carcinogen at a very, very low rate every day and not just seeing the obvious, you know, kill-on effects? And, I mean, only recently we saw glyphosate, you know, Roundup, a very, very commonly used, you know, compound. I mean, probably half of people in Britain have some, you know, for their gardening. And that's now been added to the list of carcinogens. So my view is that we always ate organic. So I would like to eat simply what our ancestors ate, because that's, you know, the way that I've adapted. In relation to milk, we have sort of interesting issues there, because we now know there are two kinds of milk. There's A1 and A2 milk.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind that we generally consume now is actually genetically different. So that may play a part. We know in research on autistic kids, they do actually react differently.
Yes.
So different kinds of milk. But also, I mean, what I say is I'm 57 years old, I'm still breastfeeding from another species of animal. Do you think I'm weird? No, I'm talking about dairy products here.
Yeah.
And so I ask people, you know, do you know any wild mammals that consume milk from their own species? In adulthood? And the answer is no. So it's very clear that milk is a substance that all mammals use during the growth period, namely childhood, and then they stop. And we're the only mammal that doesn't. And if you look at the incidence of breast and prostate cancer specifically, but also colorectal to some extent, you will find that it is the countries that have the highest dairy consumption have the highest mortality from breast and prostate cancer. And there was even a survey some years back in China across all the different regions of China. This was before kind of industrial China. And they found that the Mongols, who live on very organic and, you know, very wild, and really it's the only way they can survive, yak milk, had a higher incidence of breast cancer than other areas of China, where the peasant farmers would generally be eating a more vegetarian diet with quite a lot of tofu, you know, beans, fish, and so on. So broadly speaking, for every disease that exists, there's a country that doesn't have it. So you want to look at, you know, why does one country have a very high rate of disease and another not? And in relation to cancer, broadly speaking, the countries that have a high intake of beans and a very low intake of dairy products tend to have the lowest rates of cancer.
Mm. Okay, so your book, Say No to Cancer, originally came out in 1999, and you followed it up with a much chunkier version of the same name in 2010. So over that 16-year period, what do you think have been the most important advances in nutritional approaches to cancer?
Well, I certainly think that conceptually one of the most important is to move away from the story that it's all driven by damaged DNA.
Right.
And towards the idea that it's actually the environment of a cancer cell that is the most critical thing. But despite that, you know, sort of turnaround in thinking, it doesn't tremendously change the kind of nutrition or substances that, you know, would be used. So I think that is conceptually one of the biggest changes. One of the biggest opportunities that didn't used to exist is this ability to look, to run tests to find out about the effectiveness of different natural agents on a person's specific cancer cell type. So I think that that's that makes this whole area a lot less hit and miss. I have very recently, because I'm doing a seminar in a couple of weeks, just been going through the medical journals to look at some of the, you know, exciting and possibly beneficial cancer remedies and how they've evolved in terms of research. For example, I mentioned earlier salvestrols. Mm-hmm. Now, although the story about salvestrols is good, there is neither research to negate it nor research to support it. So the research is just very lacking. So it still stays in my sort of blue sky area. Intravenous vitamin C, high dose vitamin C, on the other hand, has a lot of research now. And what's very encouraging is that the research on its effectiveness against various different types of cancer. We also have research showing that it is remarkably non-toxic. And also there are quite a few studies now that have given intravenous vitamin C with drug-based chemotherapy and found that it almost invariably reduces the toxicity of the drug, often reduces the dose of the drug needed to be effective. So I like that area of vitamin C very much because I think that it starts to bridge a gap, and people with cancer shouldn't be caught in the very uncomfortable place, with the view that I either go, the conventional route or I go the alternative route, because I think that's the wrong way of thinking. You just need to go the most effective route. Right. And very often it's a combination of both.
Yeah, so this is integrative medicine. And mm-hmm. as a great example you've just given there, if you actually use these two things together, you get mm-hmm. a better result. Less mm-hmm. toxicity, good result. So yeah.
Yes, and I mean, the other issue is, if you have a course of chemotherapy, what do you do after it? Mm-hmm. Now, that's terribly important.
Very.
Yes.
Mm. Okay, well, look, we're getting on towards the end of the show. I'm quite interested to just do a little personal questionnaire on you now, all right?
Because yes.
I'm about what you find is important for you in your home, your life.
Yes.
Right, I've just got a list of bullet points here. I don't want to take a lot of time on each. But so let's start off with cleaning and personal care products. How much do you think it matters what you buy in that area?
No, I do think it's important. I'm not so concerned, with what I put on my hair that may wash away. I'm more concerned with what I put in my mouth.
Okay.
I actually use a sort of Weleda salt, sodium bicarb based toothpaste.
Toothpaste, yeah.
It's very, very simple stuff. Something else I do, I use a vitamin A based skin cream.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually because the cells in the skin can absorb vitamin A. And the more vitamin A you put on, the more vitamin A they store. And vitamin A is the primary antioxidant that protects you from the damage of the sun. So we want sun to make vitamin D, but if you lack vitamin A in the skin, then you can generate skin damage.
So that's your sun cream, yeah?
That's both my sun cream, cancer protector, and sort of anti-ager.
Okay. So you've already said something about organic and non-organic food. So do you buy all organic food?
I buy, I would say, probably 70-80% of my food is organic. And again, I'm interested in where it is. So, for example, if it's an orange and I'm peeling off the skin, then I'm less concerned. If it's a carrot where I'm eating the skin, then I'm more concerned. So I buy, most of my food I buy is organic. Yes.
Right. Okay. Have you got a microwave?
No, I don't have a microwave.
Would you ever have one?
Well, I had one in the very early days, and then I got divorced and gave it to my ex-wife.
Okay. How about?
I think she bought it for me in the first place.
Food and plastics. Do you keep your food in plastics?
I try to minimise plastic, and we're talking here about plasticizers. The old cling film used to use these plasticizers, which are known carcinogens. So this was the worst. The chemical was there. It was against a fatty or oily food.
Mm.
So it's when the plastic meets the food. So I use much less plastics, but I've also written to companies like Tetra Pak and the guys who make the water bottles, who assure me absolutely that they don't use any of the long list of chemicals that I sent them. So I kind of trust that. So when I have my oat milk, you know, which is in a Tetra Pak. So these Tetra Paks have a lining of plastic. I'm pretty convinced that that's not a problem.
Okay. Yeah, I've just found a PVC-free cling film as well, which I'm quite pleased about.
Yeah, it doesn't stick very well.
Doesn't it? No, I haven't used it yet, but anyway, it's quite hard to find it.
Yes.
Filtering your water, what do you do? If you've got a house system, you've got bottles of water, what do you do?
I want to move away from bottled water, you know, for environmental issues as well as the plastic, although I don't think the plastic is probably such a big issue these days. It may be in some parts of the world. I've got a plumbed-in filter.
Mm-hmm.
itdoesthejob.com is a wonderful place that supply these. They're very, very good. They cost a couple hundred quid, and once they're in, you might spend, £30-40 replacing the cartridge every year. Mm-hmm. And that will get rid of a lot of rubbish.
All right. Technology. How do you feel about mobile phones, cordless phones?
Well, here I am in London, and I have fought to minimize digital signals. Mm-hmm. So you'll notice here I have an old phone that's actually got a cable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't have a digital phone. You'll notice that my computer is plugged into it's called a DLAN system, where basically there's no Wi-Fi in my house. The signal is sent through the electrical cables, and I plug my computer in.
Okay.
However, I'm aware that I've got two neighbours.
You can't get away from your neighbours.
You can't get away from the Wi-Fi. And now I'm just setting up a farm with my son in Wales, and we're having lots of debates about Wi-Fi signals. So broadly speaking, and I do have a mobile phone, they are rather useful, but I will dial it and wait until it actually connects before I put it close to my ear. So I minimise Wi-Fi signal.
Yeah. Okay. Natural furnishings. Do you care about your carpets, all that stuff?
Yes, I do. And fire retardants so on. You know, there are definitely chemicals there. In fact, I was just on the phone on Friday about to buy a tent, a sort of safari yurt-like tent.
Yeah.
And you can buy it with or without the fire retardant. And I've said, well, which one are you using? Because there are certain fire retardants. What are they called? Bromine something or others?
Yeah, I don't know.
I also look these things up. Yes, so when I buy my household furnishings, I do check these things out.
Mm, important. And do you go as far as clothing? Do you look for natural clothing?
Generally not.
Generally not.
Honest truth, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, most of my clothes are kind of natural in the sense that they're wool or cotton or whatever.
I was just been talking to a scientist who's been looking a lot into glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
And as she pointed out, of course, an awful lot of the cotton wool we buy, you never think about cotton wool.
Mm-hmm.
Cotton wool, you just buy cotton wool. But of course, it's been grown, GM cotton that's been grown with, and it has glyphosate in it. And you clean your baby with this.
Yes.
You know, you wipe all your most delicate areas with it.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you stick it up your nose on the end of a Q-tip or whatever. You know, it's scary, really, when you start to think about these things.
Well, yes. I mean, we have introduced so many man-made chemicals, and they are all over the place. I have, in my garden in London, I grow my own veg.
Great.
not lots, but it is all organic.
Mm.
And I sort of enrich the soil, so it's good. I don't have the organic stamp of approval, but in essence, it is that way inclined.
Yeah.
And I do things like oregano. I mean, there are a lot of herbs that are not only potent anti-cancer agents, but incredibly high in natural antioxidants.
Mm.
So I grow these herbs and use them fresh, straight from the garden as much as I can.
All right, we're about out of time. So you mentioned you've got an event coming up soon. Tell us all about it.
The purpose of this event, by the way, was for people who are, dealing with cancer, wanting to know what to do, confused because there's so much information, and need to have a good chat and kind of get oriented in the right direction. So, yes, this seminar is happening on Tuesday, the 24th of November. It's in London. It's in the Holland Park area. All the details are on my website. It's from 6:30 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, the 24th of November. Say no to cancer. Go to www.patrickholford.com.
Brilliant. I shall be there. Looking forward to it.
Very good.
So thanks very much for joining me on the show. I'm sure there's going to be a great deal of listeners who will have appreciated hearing everything you've got to say about cancer.
And thank you for your wonderful work in this field.
Well, you have all the details of Patrick's London event there. They're also available, as he said, on his website, and, as usual, links to anything mentioned in the show, including Patrick's event, are on the Yes to Life website. Just click the link to Media Center in the left-hand sidebar, and then to Radio. In next week's show, I shall be speaking to Anna Rogers, who's an activist in the controversial field of breast implants. If you or any of your family have breast implants or are thinking of getting them, then this program is a must. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.